Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
The hall is lit like a laboratory, candles down the aisles, a hush that feels less like ceremony than like curiosity poised on a breath. A giant score lies open, bristling with cues, and the orchestra looks oversized even before anyone plays. Harps glinting like instruments from a myth, an army of winds and brass, timpani waiting with a patient menace. The conductor is thin and hawk-eyed, hair already showing gray. Face set in the intent look of a man who has staked his life on hearing what others cannot yet hear. He is both terrified and utterly sure. On the page before him, a melody coils, a little obsessive curve of notes, too simple to impress on paper, but destined to haunt. He has named it his Bide Fix, because it is not just a tune, but a thought he cannot put down. A person he cannot stop imagining, the shape of a fate he cannot avoid. The downbeat falls. The world, at least for 50 minutes, will belong to Hector Berlioz. He was not supposed to arrive here. He was supposed to be a doctor in Dauphiny, son of a rational father who believed in modern science and in a well-ordered life. Berlioz tried to comply. He left La Côte-Saint-André, went to Paris, enrolled in medicine, and walked into the dissecting room. There the smell and the sight, too much body, not enough person, turned him away forever. If he was to think about the heart, it would not be as muscle, but as metaphor. He defected to the conservatoire, studied composition with Lesueur, absorbed Gluck as scripture, and fell unreasonably, impractically, permanently in love with the theater, particularly Shakespeare, newly vivid in Paris through touring English actors. It was not just the plays he loved. It was an actress in them, Harriet Smithson, whose Juliet and Ophelia opened a door in him that he mistook at first for a wound. When he read Goethe's Faust, something in him recognized a fellow traveler, not a scholar in a study, but a soul impatient with the world's measured pace. Berlioz is often described as a revolutionary who used the orchestra as a laboratory and a battlefield. That is not wrong, but it misses the tenderness at the core of his audacity. He did not add instruments for spectacle alone. He added them because the existing palette could not paint the feeling he needed to show. He did not push harmony to the edge to frighten. He pushed it because honesty lives at the edge. He wrote a treatise on instrumentation, not as an abstract manual, but as a set of letters to the future. Here is how this instrument speaks when it is brave, when it is shy, when it is broken, when it prays. He wrote music criticism the way a soldier writes dispatches from a front, witty, exasperated, evangelical, merciless toward laziness, and filled with the scorn of a devotee for hacks who sell the art short. Symphonie Fantastique is the piece that fixes him in public memory, and it deserves the place. He called it an episode in the life of an artist, an autobiographical hallucination in five movements that made program music not a polite picture, but a narrative with blood pressure. The Ide Fix that winds through the work is not simply a lover's theme. It is the nerve of obsession itself, appearing as tender curiosity, as fever, as grotesque parody. In the first movement, the artist falls in love. In the second, at a ball, the melody whirls past like someone glimpsed in a mirror and lost in the next turn. In the third, in the country, the two shepherds' pipes answer each other and then leave the artist alone with his doubts. In the fourth, he dreams that he has murdered the beloved and is led to the scaffold. Brass growl, drums thud, guillotine falls. In the fifth, the Ide Fix returns as a witch's giggle amid a witch's giggle. Sabbath, the Dies Irae tolling as if the Middle Ages had come to dance in an industrial city. The shock of the score in 1830 was not only its sounds, it was the way those sounds insisted on meaning. Trombones did not roar because they could. They roared because the dream had turned into a judgment. The bells were not bells, they were architecture. The low E flat of the ophicleide, and later the tuba, was not a novelty. It was the floor of nightmare. If the story were only that he loved and suffered, it would be banal. But Berlioz transmuted private experience into public form with a kind of scientific rigor. He was not content to say, "I felt this." He asked, "What sequence of sonorities will cause another to feel it too?" In that question, you hear the confidence of someone who trusts the human nervous system to respond to pattern. You also hear the composer as dramatist. Everywhere in his mature work, he builds a sense of theater, a chorus that seems to come from across a square, a band that might be inside a military tent, a solo line that sounds like talking to oneself in a mirror. The work after Fantastique confirms that the success was not luck. Harold N. Itali was born when Paganini, that celebrity of the violin, asked Berlioz for a piece to show off a beautiful viola. He then disliked the result because the viola was not always the hero. It wandered inside the world rather than standing above it. Paganini later recognized his mistake and knelt before Berlioz in public, a tableau staged as if to embarrass fate into a kinder judgment. In Harold, the viola is the conscience of a traveler, a mind that comments but does not control. The orchestra depicts scenes. The viola remembers and connects them. Here is one of Berlioz's signatures. He lets instruments be characters without reducing them to cartoons. A cor anglais can be a pastoral voice without becoming a shepherd in costume. Four bassoons can be a comic council without ceasing to be woodwinds. The choral and sacred works carry his grandeur into public squares and churches. The Grand Messe des Morts is too big to be pious in the modest sense. It is pious in the way a cathedral is pious, by being larger than any one life and still somehow intimate when a single line rises, steady and pleading. The forces required are vast, but what matters is not the count of drums and brasses. It is the dramaturgy of distance. He places choirs of brass so that judgment seems to approach from multiple horizons. He uses silence like a spotlight. The Te Deum is not a sequel, so much as a sibling, the sound of a nation praying in public language. In both pieces, he writes for children's voices without sentimentality, as if to remind a city of the real scale of a human being. In the hybrid realm between symphony and opera, he finds a form that suited his temperament perfectly, the dramatic symphony. Romeo and Juliet is not an opera without costumes. It is a symphonic argument whose subject happens to be Shakespeare's lovers. He gives certain moments to the chorus not because they are choruses in the play, but because the collective voice is the right instrument for the thought. He writes a scherzo that feels like Mercutio, the wit dancing on its own grave. He lets the lover's night be sung, and then, as if embarrassed by our eavesdropping, he turns to the orchestra to finish the sentence. If you want to hear how Berlioz paints light itself, listen to the end, a slow ascent of harmony that behaves like dawn touching stone. He wrote operatic works that the opera houses of his day treated like misfit saints, too ardent, too long, too expensive, too honest about their own ambition. Benvenuto Cellini sparkles and stumbles because it refuses to flatten its subject into type. Beatrice A. Benedict, at the end of his life, distills wit from Shakespeare's comedy with the grace of a man whose humor has survived sorrow. And then there is Les Troyens, the tragedy that took him decades to write and that no Parisian institution of his time would treat with the respect it deserved. He split the epic into two operas for survival. Only parts were staged. Critics carped. Audiences were uncertain. But the work itself, its solemn Trojan rituals, its obsession with fate and founding, its love music that sounds like duty's dream of escape, has since proved him right. He did not write in search of fashion. He wrote as if art's job were to remember tomorrow. Because he could not always have stages and budgets, he became one of the century's great conductors. He traveled to Germany, Austria, Russia, and England, carrying his scores and others like a missionary with a traveling altar. He rehearsed with a seriousness that made players alternately grateful and nervous. He insisted on precision, not because he was a martinet, but because he knew how fragile the illusions of symphonic drama are. A single timid entrance can make a movement seem trivial. A single brave unison can make it seem inevitable. He learned orchestral psychology as if it were a branch of medicine after all. Which section needed a compliment to stay brave? Which leader needed a private scolding rather than a public rebuke? How to keep the whole extravagant organism interested in a task larger than any person's vanity? He wrote, always wrote, columns, feuilletons, essays, and finally the memoirs, one of the liveliest self-portraits a composer ever gave himself. He is funny there, sometimes unbearable, often generous, particularly toward Gluck, Weber, and Beethoven, whom he regarded as a kind of trinity. He can be unfair, as the witty often are when they write quickly, but even his unfairness illuminates the music scene of the time. Critics angling for power, impresarios risking and avoiding risk, audiences learning too slowly and forgetting too quickly, the minor heroes who hold a pit orchestra together for a decade without applause. The memoirs also show the shape of private griefs that public professionalism tries to hide, the breakdown of his marriage to Harriet Smithson, later tendernesses and losses, illnesses that drained him, the deaths of friends, the wear on a spirit that never entirely made its peace with the world's terms. Berlioz's orchestral imagination stamped itself on the future. Wagner learned from his orchestration not only colors but ways of staging sound. Liszt took program music in his own direction with the symphonic tone, but the confidence to match form to subject owes a debt to Berlioz's audacity. French composers who followed, Saint-Saëns, Franck, Debussy, Ravel, absorbed what they needed from him and left the rest. But the sense that an orchestra is not a generalized mass but a society of distinct speakers, that idea belongs to him as much as to anyone. Even film composers, who would build a century of emotional architecture beneath stories, share his instincts. The ecstatic tremor of divided strings under a confession, the ominous brass that is not evil, but the world tilting, the tam-tam that turns a transition into a revelation. He taught generations after him that a percussion stroke placed at the right moment is not effect, but punctuation. It is tempting to make his life a parable of misunderstood genius, and there is truth there. He fought for stages that would not have him. He watched smaller talents prosper. He cheered and hissed and kept writing. But the more interesting truth is that he found a way to make a life in art without the consolations of an easy market. He wrote what he must. He taught others how to play it. He traveled to those who would listen. And when Paris would not crown him, he built his own ceremonies. A city is not obligated to understand a man while he is alive. A man is not obligated to become smaller to fit a city. Between those two stubborn facts, he carved a career that looks precarious if you measure it by receipts, much less precarious if you measure it by what is played now and how audiences lean forward when it is. What is the shape of a Berlioz minute? Often it is a minute in which time seems to be doing two things at once. The bass may walk with calm steps, while the violins hover on a harmony that asks a question. The woodwinds may gossip in triplets, while the brass speak in declarative sentences. A chorus may stand like a wall while a soloist searches for a door. He builds momentum, not only by going faster or louder, but by creating parallel streams of urgency and then letting them meet. He excels at the tactic of sudden perspective. A procession that seemed grand becomes, with the entrance of a small solo instrument, simply human. A private thought becomes, with the arrival of thunderous drums, the thought of a city. He is almost cinematic in his cuts long before cinema exists. That is why he is so easy to stage in the mind. If you want single windows onto the house he built, here are a few. In Fantastique, that brief moment at the scaffold, when the ED fix emerges in clarinet one last time, tender, as if it hasn't realized what the next bar will bring, and then the chord falls like a blade. In Herald, the way the viola's line makes the boisterous march seem less like triumph than like a story someone will tell later with a sigh. In the Requiem, the quivering of strings under a choral line that climbs by steps like a pilgrim. In Romeo, the Queen Mab scherzo that makes mischief into a principle and shows what Quicksilver really sounds like. In Les Troyens, the noble, slightly archaic tread of the Trojan scenes and the intoxicating heat of Carthage. Two fates tugging at a single destiny. In Beatrice, the lightness earned by a man whose heavy pages are never heavy for long. By the end, his body was exhausted. the engine that had burned so hot for so long wearing out. He watched the city he had tried to convert remain half-converted. He could be bitter, and he had earned the right. But the music is not bitter. Even at its darkest, it is lit from within by a belief that courage in art is not a luxury. He never learned to be fashionable on cue. He learned to be himself with such intensity that fashion had to adjust later. He died in 1869, leaving a stack of pages that looked to some like monuments and to others like unfinished roads. Now the roads are crowded. Berlioz's importance is not that he was louder or stranger than his peers. It is that he was more faithful to the logic of emotion as he understood it. He trusted that a melody could behave like a person, reappear altered by experience, disintegrate under pressure, return larger than itself. He treated the orchestra not as a choir of angels, but as a city of citizens, each with rights and duties. He staged the listener's attention with the same care a playwright stages a scene. He understood that audiences do not only want to be soothed or dazzled. They want to be told the truth at a scale that matches what they suspect life is actually like. He believed, finally, that sincerity is not small. If you are going to say, I love, I grieve, I hope, say it with an apparatus worthy of the claim. The size of his forces, then, is not vanity, but proportion. If this were a museum label, we would end with dates. If it were a newspaper review, we would end with a verdict. But this is a story, and the right ending is simply to sit once more in that hall and watch him lift his hand. The melody returns, stubborn, brave, more complicated now that we have followed it through country afternoons and down scaffold steps and into the deranged joy of Sabbaths, where the dead dance, because the living cannot stop thinking about them. It is the same theme and not the same. That is Berlioz's whole argument about memory and identity. We do not repeat, we recur. And in recurrence, we either degrade or deepen. He wanted music to deepen. He believed it could. Thank you for listening to this episode of Classical Music Giants. In our next stage, we step into the dazzling, dangerous theatricality of Richard Strauss, where late romantic excess learns to speak with modern irony. Produced by Selenius Media and the Artificial Laboratory.